Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Hallett. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll hear from Elizabeth Kramer on the possibility of including genocide studies in Kentucky schools. First, the 2008 Kentucky legislative session is halfway over, and so far the House and Senate have passed far fewer bills than in past years. WFPL's Gabe Bullard has more.
Since the start of the legislative session in January, and as of this Friday morning, the Senate has passed 28 bills. That's the fewest to clear the chamber by this point in the last three 60-day sessions.
We generally are very sensitive to the need to ensure quality of the legislation, and frankly, quantity is not, like I say, is not the measure of good legislative product.
Katie Stein is the president pro tem of the Republican-controlled Senate. She says the body is passing more meaningful bills and sending them to the House. But the House hasn't passed any of the Senate's 28 bills. The Senate hasn't passed any of the House's bills either. And the House has passed fewer of its own bills, too. 50. That's less than half the average for the past three sessions. Stein says, despite the lack of action, the House and Senate are tracking each other's progress.
Things don't pass one chamber or the other in a vacuum. I mean, we're generally watching what the other chamber is doing.
By this point in the 2006 session, one bill had already been signed into law. In 2002, four were signed by the halfway point. Many more bills were eventually passed those years, but historically, most of the bills the governor signs are voted on in the last week or two before the General Assembly adjourns.
It comes so fast at the end, sometimes the members of the legislature don't even know what they're voting for or don't know the substance of the bills.
Richard Belisles is state chairman of Common Cause of Kentucky, a legislative watchdog group. He thinks the key to progress is a more efficient legislature, one that doesn't wait until the last minute to pass bills.
They're just all bunched together, and that's a problem.
That is true. That is true up to a point.
Representative Charlie Hoffman, a Democrat from Georgetown, is the House Majority Caucus leader. He attributes the pace to human nature.
There's a sizable part of the population that are procrastinators, and I think that legislators probably have about that same percentage as the makeup of our population of procrastinators, too.
Hoffman says another reason for the slow start is the political process itself. Kentucky, like most states, has a citizen legislature, one that spends most of its time out of session. While that keeps legislators connected to their constituents, it also results in a slower start to the two-month session.
One of the big parts of just about the first 20 days is the need to meet with all the different interest groups, with lobbyists and stuff that want to set the stage for what they know is going to come about this time.
Senator Katie Stein agrees.
A lot of times, you know, you need those alliances from across the state in order to get everybody in the state legislature to vote for your legislation.
While Stein thinks the time legislators spend getting to know each other and the lobbyists is worthwhile, she has another theory about the snail's pace of this session.
This governor seems to generally speak primarily to his own party members.
Stein says she's not sure why Governor Beshear hasn't spent much time with Senate Republicans, especially when he was crafting legislation to expand casino gaming, a key component of his campaign that will be a tough sell in the GOP-controlled chamber.
We have had so much success in the Senate in the past when we have worked with the minority party.
The success of the casino legislation remains to be seen, as it was just unveiled on February 14th. But right now, it's in a committee in the House, along with over 500 other bills awaiting action. For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
More than 30 states now recommend or require Holocaust or genocide studies in their public schools, and Kentucky might join them. WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer reports on how it came about and the controversy surrounding teaching the subjects in public schools.
Thea Prack came to the United States when she was 13 years old. She spent her childhood in concentration camps and running from soldiers and bandits to escape Cambodia when it was ruled by the Khmer Rouge. She later lived in refugee camps in neighboring Thailand. When she came to this country, she cried every night and didn't want to talk about her past. Now she's 37 and living in South Louisville. She works with other native Cambodians in the region to organize celebrations and often speaks publicly about her childhood. She wants people to understand that genocide is not rare. She knows from her own experiences and seeing television images from other parts of the world. They trigger memories that haunt her.
Every time I dream about going to Cambodia, I see that little girl crying, trying to find a way out. And I see this kid, and I see Darfur, Rwanda. I see these people, and I say, oh my God, I cry because that is me and my family all over again, you know, just like walking.
On the city's east side, students at the St. Francis of Assisi Catholic School have a dream of their own, to make genocide studies available to teachers and students throughout the state. These students have been studying the Holocaust and other genocides with their teacher, Fred Whitaker.
Let's pick up that discussion. Why in the world would you want to introduce middle school students to the absolute weakest points of humanity? How do we go from a person who's capable of joking about a different race, a different group? How do we become the people that can create genocide? And I'll open it up to the class.
I'm sure that people in our class have gone to people's houses and brought somebody up and gossiped about them. We've learned that we've made those mistakes and we've become bigger people, learning about our habits and how our indifference affects people around us.
These students in Whitaker worked with State Representative Mary Lou Marzian to propose a law that would help create lessons about genocide for primary and secondary school students. Last month, they testified about the legislation during a committee meeting of Kentucky's House of Representatives. The House later passed it, and it now awaits action from the state Senate's Education Committee. For Whitaker, this legislation is timely.
This is the first generation that has genocide daily on their televisions or their computers. It exposed them to the human capacity to do this sort of violence in an organized fashion. But we have yet to respond and say why you shouldn't do this and how can you prevent it.
Learning more about genocide is something filmmaker Socheta Puff thinks would have benefited her. While she learned some history of the Holocaust as a child, she didn't know much about the genocide in Cambodia. Her parents escaped the country when her mother was pregnant with her. She learned about the genocide and her family's history only as an adult. The knowledge led her to visit Cambodia with her parents and produce New Year Baby, a documentary showing at the Kentucky Center tonight.
We really, as a public, have to think about what our education is for. And if our education doesn't provide its citizens some general knowledge, basic knowledge about what it means to have a conscience, then I don't think we've really done our job in educating our citizens.
Many education groups agree. In recent years, the National Council for the Social Studies has held sessions on teaching about genocide. Members of Kentucky's Association of Teachers of History support covering the subject. Teaching about genocide in public schools has its critics, though. Neil McCluskey is a policy analyst with the Cato Institute who wrote the study, Why We Fight, How Public Schools Cause Social Conflict. He thinks the subject breeds division. He sees dilemmas in teaching about conflicts and genocide. For instance, Turkey maintains that the deaths of Armenians that began in 1915 under the Ottoman Empire weren't genocide. Armenians and most historians disagree. Neil McCluskey.
You can't boil down most of the controversies that go on in history into a simple storyline that is going to satisfy all the different groups who have things to say in what are often unresolved conflicts.
McCluskey believes teaching genocide accentuates differences and undermines his view of education's main goal, to form productive contributors to society who can take care of themselves and their families.
It's a reality, and not teaching it is bowing to a kind of perverse political correctness.
That's Diane Ravitch. She's an education historian at New York University and author of The Language Police, How Pressure Groups Restrict What Students Learn. She says not teaching genocide politicizes education.
If kids grow up knowing the basics, but having no understanding of world history or of American history, then they're going to be not very good citizens. They're going to be uninformed about the world they live in and also uninformed about the depths of depravity that people are capable of.
Meanwhile, Fred Whitaker and his students at St. Francis of Assisi say they are prepared to return to Frankfort to speak with Kentucky senators to help the bill become law. Having survived genocide, Thea Prack thinks this legislation is important.
Genocide is not something that you want to know, but it's a history that we can learn from.
For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Still to come on this week's show, Classical 90.5's Daniel Gillum talks with composer Steve Rouse about his new music based on three Frederick Hartt sculptures. First, imagine trying to manage your diet without eating traditionally produced wheat, barley, or rye products, foods with gluten in the flour. For those with celiac disease or other gluten sensitivities, it's not only tricky, but often not very tasty. Fortunately, the choices in gluten-free foods are growing, and the Rainbow Blossom New Albany Market is offering a chance to sample some, as well as meet others who are dealing with the same dietary restrictions. WFPL's Susan Sweeney Crum talked with the store's manager, Mark Clark, about the upcoming gluten-free tasting fair.
This is not your first time for the gluten-free tasting fair, but tell me a little bit about what the gluten-free tasting fair is, how many years you've done this, and what people will find if they go.
Well, the Rainbow Blossom, this will actually be our third. They did one over at the St. Matthew store, and we have had one here in the Indiana store. So this will be our second one. And what it is an opportunity for people to be able to experience food without gluten. No wheat, no gluten. We have a lot of products also that are non-dairy or no eggs, so that this is the function goes from 12 until 4 on the 23rd, and people have the opportunity to come in and taste some of the products, because a lot of times with gluten-free products, they don't taste very good. But you don't know that until you've purchased them, and then you go, ooh, and the kids won't eat them or whatever. So this is an opportunity where they get to come in and taste all kinds of food, some that we will cook ourselves. We will have around 24 vendors probably. Some of those will just have, you know, it might be crackers sitting out, or it might be a supplement. But there will be a number of different vendors and plenty of food to taste.
Now, I know that gluten products are something that people with celiac disease have to avoid in particular.
Right.
Are they the only people, or are there others who are just allergic to gluten, or is it all the same if you have celiac and also cannot eat gluten?
They're not all the same. Some people, people that have celiac definitely have a wheat gluten sensitivity or allergy or disease. A lot of people have a sensitivity so that to the gluten. Now, I think one of the reasons we're hearing more and more about it is that in the old days, that what happened is all of your grains were cut out in the fields. They were shocked and left out for the rain and the sun and the dew to ripen them, so that the enzymes in your grains actually got to activate and break down the gluten, which is a protein, so your body could utilize it. So we don't have that. There's only a couple of companies, only one that I actually know of, that will actually do that. So if you know an old farmer where they can process their food differently, but today we just go out, cut, and it's processed. So the grain never has a time or an opportunity to actually ripen. So you have people that possibly have irritable bowel syndrome. You have people that that may just have a sensitivity to wheat. You have particular blood types, like type O blood types, tend not to be able to utilize the grain as easily. So they may have a sensitivity to wheat, and it may be wheat and barley, it may be oats. So there's more than just wheat gluten sensitivities.
So in the past, I guess there's starting to be more products that are gluten-free, and are they becoming more palatable? Has it been in the past that you just plain had to avoid anything with wheat or barley in it? And is that changing for them now?
Yes. Oh, yes. There's, you know, lots and lots of people that are so sensitive that they don't even eat foods that are processed in plants that may handle wheat, or some were soy, some peanuts, you know, stuff like that. So they're real careful even about the where the companies process. So you have a whole set of companies that are really dedicated to wheat-free, gluten-free products, and they're beginning to make them taste better.
So good
there's
news.
Times when you think, wow, I didn't know this was wheat-free because it tastes so good.
Well, that's good news to those who are suffering from this and have had to avoid so many things for so long.
Absolutely. And then, you know, when people get to find out, you know, they get to taste different things, and some people will love it, some people don't, but that same, another product, some person's going to love and someone's not. And we're not just looking at children for that, you know, because we have lots and lots of adults coming in now that they just found out.
And I guess this sort of event would also be a chance for people who have this and might think to themselves, gosh, just why do I have this and I'm the only one out there? If they go to an event like this, they actually meet other people dealing with the same sort of thing they're dealing with as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And then we have one of the organizations that's going to be here is called ROCK, and that's for raising our celiac kids. So there'll be someone here to help support and nurture and network, shall we say, with other people who have children who have celiac disease.
And children, I would think it's hard enough if you've got a picky eater, but if you've got a child who can't eat certain foods, that's really got to be tough. So this is a chance for them, like you said, to try something and make sure their child's going to like it and be able to eat it and take it home. And that's got to be a big help.
That's a big help, and it's also true that sometimes it's harder for children, but sometimes it's a lot harder for the adults because they know what they're missing, and sometimes the children don't. We have one of our gals that comes in here, and she's got a little girl who's 3, and she said they went out to eat, and the waitress was asked not to bring bread to the table and explained that the little girl had celiac disease, and so the lady turned around and said, well, could I bring you a roll?
Oh.
And the 3-year-old looks up for her and says, I'm not allowed to have anything like that.
Oh my goodness.
So people don't, you know, you say bread,
right,
and they go, a slice of bread. And they're not, you know, some people don't connect it all up together, you know, but the kids do.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a golden opportunity for them to taste a lot of different things instead of, as you say, trial and error. You buy it, you like it, you don't like it.
Mm.
So it's a wonderful opportunity to, one, get an education so you actually can get more information, and also to taste the products and see what they're like.
The gluten-free tasting fair at the Rainbow Blossom New Albany Market is this Saturday, February 23rd from noon to 4 p.m. You can find out more about the event and about gluten-free diets by visiting our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, we'll learn more about the upcoming premiere of new music based on the sculptures of Frederick Hart. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. In conjunction with the University of Louisville's Frederick Hart Celebration, faculty composer Steve Roust was asked to compose a new ballet score in collaboration with choreographer Graham Lustig of the America Repertory Ballet based on 3 of Hart's sculptures. The premiere takes place February 29th and March 1st on the American Vanguards program of the ballet. Bruce Simpson, artistic director of the Louisville Ballet, and composer Steve Roust spoke with Classical 90.5's Daniel Gillum about this unique partnership.
Bruce, the Louisville Ballet has taken on kind of an exciting past few years of world premieres, company premieres. What has it been like putting on these new ballets?
I think that's the great part of my job. I think that's the fun part of my job is making sure that the artists, first of all, have ballets that can stretch them and improve their technique and their artistic capabilities, but also for the audience, that our community is so wide-based and has so many different interests. And some people really like the big classical ballets like Swan Lake and Giselle, and other people like the more contemporary stuff, and other people just like to be entertained, in fact. And so part of my challenge as the artistic director is making sure that we do programs which reach to the biggest majority of our community that we can. And, of course, having a world premiere and a commissioned work on this program is incredibly exciting, for not just for the ballet company and the dancers, but I think also for the university and the community.
Well, I imagine that putting on the classics is easier than the new ballets.
The classics, in a way, they all have their own challenges, but the classics are very, very difficult in the sense that they've been just been done so often. And so when you do them, you have to be very, very careful that the bar is raised very high. And that's from everything to the condition of the sets, to the music, to the way the dancers are dancing the ballets, and that nobody takes them for granted. And so each thing has its own challenges. I personally get very, very nervous every single time we do a big classical ballet, because that's where the company's standard lies. And as much as we do contemporary works, for example, like the Paul Taylor, which is on the program, we are the Louisville Ballet, and so we are judged by our classical work. But certainly, one also has to be aware that in someone like myself as the artistic director, you're taking care of a 400-year-old tradition. And therefore, you're taking care of the past to make sure the present is really wonderful, but also as an investment for the future, that your young dancers are being exposed and your young audience members are being exposed to the classics, so that we have an audience for the future.
Sometimes when new works are brought to orchestras, mm-hmm. especially large ensembles like the Louisville Orchestra, mm-hmm. Any other big ensemble in the country, the players sometimes are hesitant to take on new works. Are dancers the same way? Do you have
not
to coach
all.
Them?
Not at all. Quite the reverse, in fact. Dancers, I think, is part of the youthfulness, the sense of adventure one has when one's young. And also, you know, it's like, for example, if you think of playing the same piece of music every week of your life, you're going to get rather bored. And so dancers are the same. You need the challenges of new work. And also what's really important here is when works are created specifically for your body and specifically for your dance style. And therefore, in this commission, with Steve's wonderful score and Graham as the choreographer, when Graham was choreographing the piece on our dancers, he was casting and choosing people that he thought would be suitable for the work. But then at the same time, he was taking cognizance of each of their talents. And for example, there's a wonderful, wonderful solo for a guy called Keith Glenn in the ballet. And it's so explosive and so exciting. And it is around the capability that Keith can move like the wind and very, very quickly and has a phenomenal jump and a fantastic technique. And then you get someone like Natalia Ashikhmina, who's a wonderful Russian ballerina. And the section that she does in the ballet suits her lyricism and her elegant classical qualities. And so it's wonderful for the dancers. I think it's one of the attractions of the Louisville Ballet is that because we've done so many new works over the past 5 or 6 years, people want to actually work with this company because they know that they will develop as artists.
Well, let's just talk for a minute or so about this specific ballet. Mm-hmm. And maybe, Bruce, since you've seen it and heard it, what is your take? How do you feel about it?
I just love it, and I've loved it from the inception. Our resident choreographer, Adam Hochland, is in his 20s and lives in New York, and he is of this generation. He has a viewpoint which is 25 years behind mine, and that's the great thing. He punches up against my head all the time about new ideas and youthfulness. But in the search for a choreographer for Steve's music, it was very important for me that it was someone whose sensibilities and sensitivity matched the Frederick Hart sculptures on the doors of the National Cathedral in Washington. And in choosing Graham Lustig, that goes back in my memory almost 20 years ago when he did a ballet for the Royal Ballet called Paramore. And it was its Michelangelo kind of a sculptured quality, and at the same time its romanticism, which I thought was incredibly attractive. And I thought it would be a great match for Steve in this collaboration. And also in the choice of the designers, in Sandra Woodall with the costumes and Alex Nichols with the scenic elements. You have to be very, very careful that you're not, that the music isn't saying one thing, that it's not, you know, playing lilac and we're trying to dance pink. You know, all these different elements have to be brought together. That's my job. But then as an artistic director, I tend to try not to interfere once the artists are there. Obviously, my advice is sought, and I try to give advice. But as far as the creators are concerned, for example, like with Steve, I have practically said nothing about the musical elements, in fact, except for my discussions with Graham about the length of the piece, the structure of the piece, the time signatures, that kind of thing. But I tend to, once the different elements are there, I try not to interfere, because there's nothing worse for an artist than having someone interfere when you're being creative. I feel. I may be wrong, but I try to stay away.
Steve, and on that same point, how do you feel about the ballet and matching your music with their movements?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, my contribution has been outside of the ballet studio altogether. It's been in discussion with Graham and in discussion with Bruce and thoughts about the heart work. So it's in some ways it's been created outside of the choreography itself, and Graham was then setting the music on the dancers. So it's my sense of it is coming in as a after the fact and watching this fabulous unfolding of the choreography that Graham's done and the work of the dancers in the company. It's fantastic to watch that come to life in a different, my own music come to life in a different meaning.
I think we were fortunate and unfortunate in that with the opening of the exhibition at the university in September, we were desperate to try and get a piece of the ballet done before that point rather than having it all done now in February. And Graham, at the end of the summer when the dancers came back on contract in August, was in actual fact on his way to do a piece for Singapore Dance Theatre in Singapore. And he had 5 days free in the middle of that, and it happened to be our first week back. And so he arrived to a company he had never seen before. He was taking everything on faith of my opinions of what this dancer was talented in this area and this dancer was talented in that area. And within 4 days, he literally choreographed seven minutes of the piece, which we presented at the university for the opening of the exhibition. And I was absolutely amazed at the speed of the creativity, because he had been talking to Steve all the way through the summer and was so involved in the music, and obviously it had permeated not just his skin but his very being. And therefore, when he walked onto the floor with the dancers, he really had a very, very strong idea about what he wanted to achieve in those 4 days. And the result of all of that, it gave him time to go to Singapore to mature inside his creative spirit about where he wanted the piece to go. And then when he came back to finish the ballet, certainly it's changed considerably since then, but it still has the same beautiful elements that we required to go with Steve's wonderful score. And I'm just so extraordinarily excited about all of this, because in today's world, especially to commission a ballet, and to get a ballet onto the stage from scratch, is very expensive. And a lot of people don't like you taking risk. Mm. They want it to be safe. If they're putting money into a project, they want that project to be safe. And for people to invest in this with such huge risk, a completely new score, completely new choreography, new scenic elements, new costumes, all of those are extraordinarily high artistic risks. And I'm just very, very excited that it's all come together so smoothly. In fact, it's been a heavenly experience almost.
Well, I think, Steve, you have a lot of experience in dance and accompanying ballet companies and dance companies and writing ballet scores. But this wasn't an easy project for you. What were some of the challenges with Graham or the Louisville Ballet in composing this particular work?
Well, my experience happened almost 30 years ago, and I spent 3 years working with a dance division at a university as a accompanist and composer for them, and also production and music, which was a fantastic experience. And there I learned to really love dance and the whole world of dance and dancers. And I really enjoyed working with choreographers through that time period. We had some people coming in from New York, and it was just a great experience. But it had been a long time. So it was a terrific feeling to get back to that, and one of the things that I enjoyed was that world is an entirely different a world of expression than, say, just the concert stage. There's all about movement, and the music just somehow seems different. The challenges were only unique in this situation for me, in that we would not have an opportunity to have the score performed by the orchestra first. So I had to provide Graham with something to some sort of sound image of the work as I wrote it, so that he could then choreograph on his on in private and bring this to the or at least gather his ideas in private about the music. But those were the big challenge, and how to produce a reasonably good sounding audio so that Graham could work, and also that the dancers could rehearse, because we're only going to have a couple of days with the orchestra to put this together with the live musicians.
And speaking about the musicians, this is also a unique project in that the Symphony Orchestra from the University of Louisville will be performing this premiere, correct?
I think this is one of the most exciting things about it. We did a piece at the beginning of the season, Magic Flute, the opera, as a ballet. And that was a wonderful collaboration with 50 singers in the choir from the University of Louisville and 10 singer soloists in the orchestra pit, and then the opera. That's such an extraordinary piece of Mozart being transferred into a visual art on the stage as a ballet. And I think these collaborations within our community are really, really important. And I think as part of my background that I enjoy these so much, for example, my first collaboration as a young dancer when I was 15 years old, in fact, was with the Scottish Opera, as a dancer with the Scottish Opera. So I was exposed to opera and different other art forms, performing art forms, when I was very young. And one of the reasons I actually came to Louisville was the fact that there was so much collaboration that went on between the different arts groups here, between the opera and Actors Theatre and the orchestra and the ballet, to name four. And so, therefore, this collaboration to bring in the University of Louisville again, this time with the orchestra, is, for me, I mean, there may be a lot of people who sit in the audience and they're not really aware of the strength and the size of those collaborations. But as the artistic director of the ballet company, I think it's absolutely crucial that we have such wonderful partnerships and that we do use them when we possibly can.
Steve, for you, in a way, it's almost like composing for your resident orchestra, because you know these kids who are young adults who are playing. What was it like creating a score thinking that they might be the players for your premiere?
Well, interestingly, I've never written for the university orchestra.
Really?
They performed a couple of my pieces, but I've never had the opportunity to write for them. So this is actually a first opportunity.
Well, okay.
Now, yeah. I've gotten to hear the orchestra many mm-hmm. times over the past few years, so I know roughly the nature of the players and what they're capable of, which is something pretty terrific these days. Kim Lloyd does a fantastic job with the orchestra. Mm-hmm. And so it was a little bit of a new experience, and because we didn't know for sure who would be playing at first, I had to sort of, in some ways, write the music so that it would work wherever, however. And so that was another parameter to keep in mind as I was working.
Have you been to some rehearsals and heard some of their playing already of your piece?
I've been told to stay away for a while.
Okay. That happens sometimes. Yeah. That's okay.
I think one of the elements that's really also exciting is about the age we live in, with all this technology and emails and all that kind of thing, and this fantastic ability for Steve to actually send by the internet pieces of the music that he had composed to Graham and myself very early on. And I was in many ways absolutely staggered. I mean, when I think of when I was a young person and someone composed a ballet or wrote a piece of music, we actually never heard it until the piano score came into the studio. Mm-hmm. And then even then, you weren't sure about what you were going to hear because you weren't sure of the orchestration or the instrumentation. Mm-hmm. And certainly on a piano, something can sound very, very different to a tuba or to an oboe, for example. And that was always part of the process for us. And here the dancers in the Louisville Ballet have an extraordinarily lucky situation in that Steve has been able to send us, by digital processes these days, almost a complete score. And that's been extremely helpful for the dancers to hear the mood and the ambience and whatever they need to hear within the orchestra. And that's been extremely helpful.
Yeah, that audio, I mean, it's a digital audio. It's actually, I think, pretty good, but the real version, the real orchestra, will sound 100 times better and more
different.
Interesting and more varied. But at the same time, this is a lot closer than just, say, a piano score.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's very much, you know, all the instrument sounds are there, at least, and I think it does help a lot. Mood, character comes through.
And also, I think from the dancer's perspective, that's one of the most exciting things when you're having a role created for you. and then you actually hear the orchestra play it for the first time, the resonance in what you actually hear. Because, for example, because of the structure of the pit or the auditorium and the acoustics within that stage, or, for example, the Kentucky Center with its special acoustic, you hear things in a different way. And depending where you're standing and dancing on the stage, you hear different things in the orchestra. And that colors the way you move in space. And that also brings an element to it, which, again, this development from the very first day of rehearsal. I mean, the dancers are so excited about simple things, for example, going for a costume fitting. And Sandra Woodall's designs, which are, of course, need to look like sculpture, and yet at the same time people can't look naked as they are in the actual sculptured pieces, has been an incredible challenge, and she's done a wonderfully creative job of doing things to the human body with stretch fabrics that are just absolutely wonderful. And again, all those elements, I think, with Steve's score, it makes for a very unusual situation, and I don't think people realize that to have a commissioned score in a completely new commissioned piece going onto the stage at the Kentucky Center is highly unusual and to be treasured, and it adds to the facet of the wonderful arts we have here in Louisville.
One thing that I wanted to mention is that when I was brought into the project, Dean Doan of the School of Music, and Bruce sort of invited me into this project. It was about the work of Frederick Hart, and that was the inspiration for the work. And there, I spent a lot of time looking at the work and examining the work, and I was struck by very much the human and also the deeply expressive qualities of this work. And I knew that anything that we did with music, or that I did with music, would have to capture that somehow. And I think that was first and foremost in the minds, in Bruce's mind and Graham's mind. And when we all got together, we knew that somehow this music had to be, I had to try to make it as expressive and also as lyrical as possible, because that's really the essence of Hart's work. And
yes, I think that to get back to what I was saying earlier about the choice of choreographer in Graham Lustig, Graham has an international reputation of creating ballets in all different kinds of genre. For example, he's busy at the moment with a theater piece based on the life of Anne Frank, on the last week of her life. And so you couldn't be further away from Between Stillness to a piece on Anne Frank. But at the same time, we did have to find someone that was sensitive to and could absorb the sculptures on the front of the National Cathedral in Washington, and the way that Graham has created it as almost a kind of triptych, with the one door being day and the other side panel, other door being night, and Ex Nihilo being in the center. And he's definitely, I think, in a very, very beautiful way, managed to express those sculptures without being literal, because we can't put those sculptures up on the stage, and that is not what we wanted to achieve. So anyone that thinks they're going to come and see a literal rendition of the sculptures is going to be mistaken, because that's not what we wanted to achieve. But what we wanted to achieve was the deep spirituality and beauty of those sculptures and what they mean today in the American mind as far as that kind of sculpture is concerned, as opposed to an Ian Calder or Andy Warhol or other artists that have different things to say. And therefore, in the choice of the choreographer and the designers, we were very, very careful that they would have the sensitivity, the right kind of sensitivity, to express what Frederick Hart was saying in those wonderful pieces.
That's Daniel Gillum of Classical 90.5 talking with Bruce Simpson, Artistic Director of the Louisville Ballet, and Steve Rouse, a composer and faculty member at the University of Louisville. Rouse composed the score to the ballet Between Stillness, with choreography by Graham Lustig of the American Repertory Ballet. It will receive its premiere on February 29th and March 1st as part of the American Vanguards program of the Louisville Ballet. Blues music in the United States has a long history with roots dating back to the early 20th century, but many people may not know much about it. The Filson Historical Society in Louisville is dedicating an evening to blues history with music, instruments, old records, and more this week. WFPL's Susan Sweeney Crum spoke with director Mark Wetherington about the Blues Night at the Filson.
Is this a first-time event? And tell me a little bit about why you're doing it.
No, I think this may be the fourth time that we've had Blues Night at the Filson, and we've always used the 10th Street Blues Band. So it goes back several years, and this is a part of a music series we do here at Filson as a part of our overall programming. We have several thousands of pieces of sheet music here as a part of our collection, and we try to connect our programs to our collections, and most of that sheet music is 19th century sheet music. But we're trying to build in areas where we have some gaps, and the blues would be one of those.
So Tell me a little of the historical significance of the blues, specifically in Louisville. I mean, I know there's a lot of people who like blues music and who know there's a history there, but maybe don't really, wouldn't have thought of it as, I mean, when you think of Filson Historical Society, you think of things from hundreds of years back.
Right,
and
right.
What the connection is specifically with Louisville and that you're doing with the blues music.
We're really trying right now. We have an initiative underway to build our 20th century collection across the board. But we have, again, the music collection. The blues have been sort of up and down here in Louisville, and certainly in the late 1890s and early in this century, there were examples of musicians being here. There's a frequently cited case of John Jacob Niles, who was a Kentucky folklorist and wrote ballads, who remembered his father saying that he saw a Louisville blues shouter performing in a medicine show in Louisville as early as 1898. So the tradition and the style goes back, 100 years. It's very often difficult to document that. We're going to have some examples of blues artifacts, instruments, records, photographs, et cetera, on display on February the 22nd at Blues Night. So we'll be able to learn more about that. Penn Bogart, who is a former Filson staff member, is a member of the band, and he weaves in the blues story and the blues experience here in Louisville and the region as a part of the program.
Are there any names from blues beginnings that people would know from Louisville in particular?
Well, Sylvester Weaver, who apparently recorded one of the first, if not the first, blues guitar instrumentals in 1923, was from Louisville. And so that's an example of someone who is a connection here with Louisville. There's still a lot of work, I think, to be done on research here and the records to flesh out that story. And an event like this brings public attention to a tradition that continues in groups like the 10th Street Blues Band.
So they'll be performing. What will the evening end? You mentioned some of the different artifacts and instruments, but what all, music-wise, will the evening involve?
Well, in the past, they cover a good bit of ground. They'll be doing primarily songs from probably the 50s and 60s. Some of the musicians in this group, Sonny Sitgraves, who plays the drums, and James Watkins, who plays bass. Well, Sitgraves played in Chicago with people like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and others, and Watkins toured in the 60s with rhythm and blues groups, including the Four Tops. So they'll draw on those traditions, and having heard them, at least three or four times now, they'll do, things like Jimmy Reed and Muddy Waters and things like that. So people really enjoy it. It's a good evening.
Sounds like it's starting to become a tradition for the Filson Club itself.
Well, I was going to use that word, but you beat me to it. Yeah, it is a tradition, and we really enjoy it.
And how many people have you had in the last few years, and what kind of a crowd are you looking for?
Well, we've had up to we hold this in the first floor of our headquarters here at 1310 South 3rd Street in the Ferguson And so we can get usually around 70 people in here. So it's a nice environment. This is a 1906 Beaux-Arts residential structure, and it's got a lot of beautiful woodwork, and it's very intimate and close. So you'll be right up with the band.
Yeah, it sounds like it should be fun. And it starts at 7:30. About how long do you think this will go on?
It will go on till 9:30.
Okay.
So they'll usually play 45 minutes to an hour and then take a break and then play at least till around 9:15, and then we'll start winding up the evening.
Sounds good. Not only just a nice time to enjoy some good music, but perhaps learn a few things while you're there as well.
Absolutely. It's a great opportunity to hear some really talented musicians and learn about the musical traditions and history of Louisville and in our region.
Blues Night at the Filson is this Friday, February 22nd at 7:30. You can find out more about the event and about the blues at our website, WFPL.org. More information about today's show is available online at WFPL.org. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts and our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.